Suna always cared deep down. He wanted the players to like him. The fans, the old men and women in the bearskin. The whole town. But Elizabeth Zakel isn't afraid of opinions, because she knows what all successful coaches know. They'll like her when she wins. "I'm going to get something to eat," she says, managing to sound neither friendly nor unfriendly. Suna nods, smiles again, leaves her with one last thought. "Do you remember that little girl, Alicia, who was firing pucks in my garden? She came to the rink today. 7 times. She ran away from her preschool to watch the A-team train. I took her back, but she ran away again. She's going to keep on doing that all autumn." "Is it possible to lock children up?" Zakel wonders, possibly not quite understanding the point Suna is trying to make. So Suna clarifies, "Children take all the things they grow up with for granted. After watching you coach the A-team today, Alicia will take it for granted that women do that. When she's old enough to play on an A-team, there may not be female hockey coaches. Just hockey coaches." That means something to Suna. Something important. He doesn't know if it means anything to Elizabeth Zakel, because it honestly doesn't look as though it does. She just looks as though she wants to go and get something to eat. But hunger is a feeling, too. Just before Zakel walks out through the door, something flashes in her eyes. Something she does actually care about. So she asks, "How's it going with my goalie? That Vidar?" "I'll talk to his brother," Suna promises. "Didn't you promise that Peter was going to talk to Benjamin Ovich's sisters, too?" Zakel wonders. "Yes," Suna says in surprise. "So why didn't Benjamin come to training today?" "He didn't?" Suna exclaims. It hadn't even occurred to him that Benji might not have appeared for practice. Children aren't the only ones who take things for granted. In a cabin on a campsite sits a man in a blue polo shirt. He has lessons to prepare, a teaching job he has spent several years training for, but can't get anything done. He sits in the little kitchen with a book about philosophy on the table in front of him, staring out through the window and hoping to see a young man with sad eyes and a wild soul. But Benji doesn't come. He's lost. Today the teacher looked him in the eye and told him he was a mistake, even though the mistake was the teacher's. Everyone in this town knows that Benji is dangerous because he strikes hardest. Yet few people seem to appreciate that everything about him does just that. Strike hardest, beat hardest, the whole time, including his heart. Inside the Ovich's home, one of the sisters, Gabby, walks into Benji's room. Gabby's 2 children are playing with Legos scattered across the whole floor. Gabby can say many harsh things about her little brother, but there's no better uncle in the world. Her children will grow up saying that this room in their grandmother's house, their uncle's room, was the safest place in the entire universe. Nothing bad could happen to them here. No one would dare do anything to them, because their uncle would protect them against everyone and everything. Once one of them said to Gabby, "Mom, there are ghosts in Uncle Benji's wardrobe. They have to hide in there because they're scared of him." Gabby smiles and is just walking out of the room when the thought hits her. She spins around and asks the children, "Where did you get the Legos?"
"It was in the presents,"
the children reply, unconcerned.
"What presents?"
The children go into defense mode as if they'd been accused of theft.
"The presents on Uncle Benji's bed. They had our names on them, Mom. They were for us."
The doorbell rings. Gabby doesn't walk to answer it. She runs. Audrey, the oldest sister, opens the door. Ahmed, Benji's teammate, is standing outside. The boy doesn't get worried until he sees how worried Audrey gets, but she realizes everything all at once. "Is Benji home?" Ahmed asks, although he already knows the answer.
"Shit,"
Audrey replies. Gabby comes rushing out into the hall, yelling, "Benji left presents for the children!" Amit clears his throat nervously. He wasn't at practice. I just wanted to check that he was okay. He calls the last words after Audrey. She's already run past him, heading toward the forest. Benji occasionally skips practices, but never the first of the season. His feet are too desperate to get back onto the ice. His hands miss his stick. His brain the flight across the rink. He wouldn't miss the chance to play today. Not when Beartown is playing Hied in the first round of games. Something's wrong. Ramona is standing behind her counter the way she always has, with as little emotional disturbance as possible. She's seen this town blossom, but in recent years, she's also seen it take a beating. People in Beartown know how to work, but they need somewhere to do it. They know how to fight, but they need something to fight for. The only thing you can rely on in all towns, big and small alike, is that there will be broken people. It's nothing to do with the place, just life. It can beat us up. And if that happens, it's easy to find your way to a pub. Bars can quickly become sad places. Someone who has nowhere else to go can grasp a glass a little too tightly. Someone who's tired of falling can take refuge in the bottom of a bottle, seeing as you can't fall much further from there. Ramona has seen fragile souls come and go here. Some have moved on, and some have gone under. Things have gone well for some of them, and some, like Ilan Ovich, have gone off into the forest. Ramona is old enough neither to jump with joy when things are going well, nor to bury herself when things are going badly, and she knows how easy it is to have unrealistic expectations of a hockey team in an autumn like the one they're facing now. Because sports isn't reality, and when reality is hell, we need stories. Because they make us feel that if we can just be best at one thing, perhaps everything else will turn and start to go our way too. But Ramona really can't say, can things ever turn around? Or do we just get used to them? The last thing Ilan Ovich did before he took his rifle and went out into the forest was to leave presents for his children on their beds. No one knows why someone would get it into his head to do a thing like that, but perhaps he was hoping that that was how they'd remember him, that he could go far enough into the forest for them to believe he had just abandoned them, so that they could fantasize that he was a secret agent who had been called away on a top-secret mission, or an astronaut who had gone up into space. Perhaps he hoped they would have a childhood, in spite of everything. It didn't turn out that way. Audrey, his eldest, will never be able to explain how she knew where he was. She just had a feeling about where he'd gone. Maybe that's why dogs like her, because she has a heightened sensitivity to things that normal people lack. She didn't shout, "Dad!" as she moved through the trees. The children of hunters don't do that. They learn that every man in the forest tends to be someone's dad. So if you want to get hold of yours, you have to shout his name as if you were just anyone. Audrey never became just anyone, not entirely. She was born with something of Ilan in her. He could never go far enough into the forest for her not to be able to find him. A pub can be a gloomy place because, taken as a whole, life always gives us more opportunities for grief than celebration, more funeral drinks than wedding toasts. But Ramona knows that a pub can be other things, too, from time to time. Small cracks in the blocks of stone you carry in your chest. It doesn't always have to be the best place on earth. It just doesn't always need to be the worst. The past few weeks have been full of rumors. It's said that the factory is going to be sold, and Beartown has been through enough setbacks to know that this could just as easily mean bankruptcy. It's easy to call that attitude cynical, but cynicism is simply a chemical reaction to too much disappointment. The young men in the bearskin aren't the only people talking about unemployment. Everyone is worried now. In a small community, the loss of any employer is a natural disaster. Everyone knows someone who's affected, until eventually it spreads to you. And it might be easy to call the inhabitants paranoid when they keep saying that the politicians focus all their resources on Hied, and don't give a damn if Beartown even survives another generation. But the worst thing about paranoia is that the only way to prove you're not paranoid is to be proved right. Some children never quite manage to escape their parents. They're guided by their compass, see through their eyes. When terrible things happen, most people become waves, but some people become rocks. Waves are tossed back and forth when the wind comes, but the rocks just take a beating, immovable, waiting for the storm to blow over. Audrey was a child, but she took the rifle from her father and sat on a stump holding his hand in hers. Perhaps it was shock, unless she was consciously saying goodbye, both to him and to herself. She became someone different after that. When she stood up and walked back through the forest to Beartown, she didn't scream for help in panic. She walked purposefully to the homes of the best and strongest hunters so that they could help her carry the body. When her mother collapsed screaming in the hall, Audrey caught her, because the girl had already done her crying. She was ready to be the rock. Has been ever since. Katya and Gabby were their mother's children, but Audrey and Benji were their father's. Causes of conflict, finders of war. So every time Audrey has set off into the forest to look for her little brother since then, she knows she's going to find him, as if he had magnets under his skin. That's not what she's scared of. She's scared he's going to be dead, every time. Younger brothers never know what they put their big sisters through. Anxiety hidden behind eyes, words hidden behind other words, keys to gun cabinets hidden under pillows at night. Benji isn't sitting in a tree. He's lying on the ground. Elizabeth Zekel walks into the bearskin. It's long past dinner time, but she takes a seat in one corner, and Ramona takes her a large plate of potatoes without her having to ask. "Thanks," the coach says. "I don't know what vegetarians like you eat apart from potatoes, but there are mushrooms in the forests around here. They'll soon be in season," Ramona replies. Zekel looks up. Ramona nods sternly. The bar owner isn't big on emotions either, but this is her way of saying she hopes the hockey coach is going to stick around for a while. Benji's body is still. His eyes open, but his gaze far away. Audrey can still remember how her dad's hand felt when she sat there on the stump as a child. How cold it was. How still, without the pulse running through it. Carefully, gently, without making any noise at all, the big sister lies down on the ground beside her little brother, her hand on his, just to feel the heat and heartbeat within. "You'll be the death of me. Don't you dare lie on the ground when I'm looking for you, you stupid pea brain," she whispers. "Sorry," Benji whispers. He is neither drunk nor high. He isn't running from his feelings today. That makes her more worried. "What's happened?" The last light of summer bounces off the tears clinging to Benji's eyelashes. "Nothing. Just a mistake." Audrey doesn't reply. She isn't the sister who talks about broken hearts. She's just the sister who fetches her brother home from the forest. She waits until they're getting close to the edge of town before she says, "The new coach is thinking of making you team captain." She sees something in Benji's eyes that she hasn't seen for many years. He's scared. Zekel has almost finished her meal when Ramona returns to the table and puts a beer down in front of her. "From the regulars," Ramona says. Zekel looks over at the five old men at the bar. "Them?" Ramona shakes her head. "Their wives." In the far corner sit five old women. Gray hair, handbags on the table, wrinkled hands tightly clutching glasses of beer. Several of them have children and grandchildren who work at the factory. Some of them work there themselves. The old women have old bodies, but new t-shirts. all the same. Green, with four words written on them like a war cry. Beartown against the rest. Chapter 22. Team Captain. There's no real autumn in Beartown, just a quick blink before winter. The snow doesn't even have the manners to let the leaves decompose in peace. The darkness comes fast, but at least these months have been full of a lot of light. A club that fought and survived. A grown man who put a reassuring hand on a 4.5-year-old's shoulder. Hockey that was more than a game. Beer on a stranger's table. Green t-shirts that said, "We fight together, no matter what." Boys with the biggest dreams. Friends who formed an army. Unfortunately, that isn't what we're going to remember in a few years' time. Many of us will just look back on these months and remember the hatred. Because that's how we function, for better or worse. We always define different periods by their worst moments. So we will remember two towns loathing for each other. We will remember the violence, because it's only just started. Of course, we won't talk about it. We don't do that here. We'll talk about hockey games that were played instead, so that we don't have to talk about the funerals that took place between them. Darkness has settled comfortably upon Beartown and Hyed as a thin figure makes its way through the forest. It's starting to get cold now. The days don't let on, but the nights are honest, not hiding temperatures below freezing behind rays of sunlight. The figure shivers and hurries on, as much from nerves as to keep warm. The ice rink in Hyed doesn't have an alarm, and the building is old and full of back doors that someone might forget to lock. The figure doesn't have a detailed plan of how the break-in is going to work, just a vague idea of padding around the building and feeling all the door handles. He has no luck there, but does better with one of the bathroom windows. He manages to pry it open, even if it takes the full strength of the 12-year-old's arms. Leo climbs inside, runs through the gloom. He's played enough away games in Hyed to know where the locker rooms are. The A-team has its own lockers. Most of them don't have the players' names on them, but some of the players are too infatuated with their own names to be able to resist the opportunity to write them on the labels at the top. Leo uses the flashlight on his cell phone to find William Leeds. Then he does what he came to do. Audrey, Katya, and Gabiovich bang on the door of the bearskin after closing time. Ramona yells, "I've got my shotgun loaded," which is her way of saying, "I'm afraid we're closed." But the Ovich sisters march inside all the same, and Ramona jumps when she sees all three of them. "What have I done now?" she pants. "Nothing, we just want to ask a favor of you," Katya says. "Nothing. When the three of you come through that door together, an old bag can't help but think she's going to get a beating. Surely to God you can understand that," Ramona whimpers, clutching her chest theatrically. The sisters grin, as does Ramona. She puts beer and whiskey on the bar, then pats each of them fondly on the cheek. "It's been a long time since I saw you. You're still too beautiful for this town." "Flattery like that won't get you anywhere," Audrey says. Ramona nods. "That's why the good Lord gave us strong liquor." "How are you?" Gabby asks. Ramona snorts. "I'm starting to get old. And it's shit, let me tell you. Your back aches and your eyesight starts to go. I don't give a damn about dying, but this aging business, I can't see the point of it." The sisters smile. Ramona slams her empty glass down on the counter and goes on. "So, what can I do for you?" "We need a job," Audrey says. When the Ovich sisters emerge from the bearskin, their little brother Benjamin is leaning against the wall. Audrey knocks the cigarette out of his hand, Katya folds his collar down roughly, and Gabby licks her fingers and combs his hair with them. They curse him and tell him they love him in the same sentence, the way only they can. Then they push him through the door. Ramona is standing behind the counter, waiting. "Your sisters say you need a job." "Apparently so," Benji mutters. Ramona can clearly see Ilanovich's eyes in his son's face. Your sisters say you're restless, that you need to be kept busy. They can't stop you from ending up at the counter, in a bar, but they can at least try to make sure you end up on the right side of it. I told Audrey that giving you work as a bartender could be like leaving a dog to guard a steak, but she's not the sort of person you can reason with, that one. And Katya swore you've got experience of being behind a bar from her place in Hied. Is that the place the Reds call the Barn? Benji nods. The Reds is what Ramona calls people from Hied. I'm not welcome there anymore because a degree of conflict about aesthetic matters arose between me and the native population, he explains. Ramona doesn't have to roll up Benji's sleeve to know that there's a tattoo of a bear under it. She has a weakness for boys who love this town more than they should have the sense to. Can you pour a beer without spilling it? Yes. What do you get if you ask to run a tab? A slap in the face? You're hired. Thanks. She snorts. Don't say that. I'm only doing this because I'm frightened of your sisters. Benji smiles. Everyone with any sense is. Ramona gestures toward the shelves on the walls. We have two types of beer, one type of whiskey, and the rest is mostly for decoration. You wash the glasses and clean, and if there's a fight, you don't get involved. You hear me? Benji doesn't disagree, which is a good start. He clears the backyard of a pile of wood and tin that's been lying there for months. He's strong as an ox and knows how to keep his mouth shut, Ramona's two favorite character traits. When it's time to turn the lights out and lock up, he helps her up the stairs to her apartment. There are still photographs of Holger, her husband, everywhere. Him and Beartown Ice Hockey, her first and second loves, green flags and pennants on every wall. You can ask what you want to ask now, Ramona says mildly, patting the young man on the cheek. I don't want to ask anything, Benji lies. You're wondering if your dad used to come to the Bearskin, if he used to sit in the bar down there before he went off into the forest. Benji's hands disappear into the pockets of his jeans, and the years are stripped away from his voice. What was he like? The boy asks. The old woman sighs. Not one of the best, not one of the worst. Benji turns toward the stairs. I'll take the garbage out. See you tomorrow evening. Ramona takes hold of his hand and whispers, You don't have to become like him, Benjamin. You've got his eyes, but I think you can become someone else. Benji isn't ashamed of crying in front of her. Early the next morning, Elizabeth Zakel sticks her head into Peter Anderson's office. Peter is wrestling with an espresso machine. Zakel watches. Peter presses a button, and brown water dribbles out of the bottom of the machine. Peter panics and presses all the buttons at the same time, while simultaneously reaching with an impressive display of acrobatics for a roll of paper towels while he balances in front of the leaking machine on one foot. And I'm supposed to be the weird one for not drinking coffee, Zakel notes. Peter looks up, still in the middle of some sort of modern dance interpretation of office cleaning, swearing in a way that Zakel has reason to believe is very unlike him. Shit. Shall I come back later? Zakel wonders. This damn contraption is a complete nightmare, but it was a gift from my daughter, Peter admits, embarrassed. Zakel offers no reaction. I'll come back later, she concludes. Sorry. What can I do for you? Have your wages been paid okay? Peter wonders. It's about rope, Zakel says. But Peter has already launched into his defense. The new sponsor, our contract isn't quite in place, but everyone should have been paid by now. He wipes the sweat from his brow. Zakel repeats, I'm not here about my paycheck. I'm here about rope. Rope? Peter echoes. I need rope and a paintball gun. Can you buy those around here? A paintball gun? Peter echoes again. Zakel explains in a monotone, but not impatiently. Paintball is a war simulation game played on a specially designed course. Two teams shoot at each other with small pellets of paint fired from guns. I need one of those guns. I know what paintball is, Peter assures her. It didn't sound like it, Zakel says in her own defense. Peter scratches his hair, getting coffee on his forehead. He doesn't notice, and Zakel spares him the panic that telling him would probably trigger. They probably have rope in the hardware store opposite the Bearskin pub. Thanks, Zakel says, and is already out in the corridor before Peter has time to call out. What do you want rope for? You're not going to hang anyone, are you? Then he says it again with genuine concern in his voice. Zakel, you're not going to hang anyone, are you? We've got enough problems as it is. Benji's former coach, David, used to say that Benji would be late for his own funeral. If his teammates didn't check that number 16 was out on the ice, he could easily be lying asleep in the locker room when the game started. Sometimes he missed practices. Sometimes he showed up high or drunk. But today he arrives at the rink on time, gets changed at once, and goes straight out onto the ice. Elizabeth Zakel turns toward him as if she's surprised that a hockey player has turned up for hockey practice. Benji takes a deep breath and apologizes, the way you learn to do if you've big sisters who hit hard. Sorry I didn't come to practice yesterday. Zakel shrugs. I don't care if you come to practice. Benji notices that there are 5 thick ropes lying on the ice, several yards long. Zakel is holding a paintball gun in her hand. The hardware store in Beartown didn't have any, but the one in Hied managed to find one in the storeroom. A scattering of small paint spatters on the plexiglass in one corner of the rink indicates that Zakel has already practiced firing the hard little pellets of paint. What are you doing? Benji asks, baffled. What are you doing here so early? Zakel counters. Benji looks at the time. He's right on time for the practice, but the only other players on the ice are Amit and Bobo. He grunts. My sister says you're thinking of making me team captain. That's a bad idea. Zakel nods without blinking. Okay. Benji waits for her to go on. She doesn't, so he asks, why me? Because you're a coward, Zakel says. Benji has been called many things in his life, but never that. You're full of crap, she nods. Maybe. But I'm giving you the thing you're most terrified of. Responsibility for other people. Benji's eyes darken. Hers are expressionless. Amit is standing behind them, his skates twitching with restlessness, until he eventually loses patience and blurts out, Practice is supposed to start now. Why don't you go and get the others from the locker room? Zakel shrugs her shoulders nonchalantly. Me? Why would I care about that? Benji squints at her, increasingly frustrated. He looks at the time again. Then he leaves the ice. A lot of the older players in the Beartown locker room are only half-changed when Benji walks in. Practice is starting, he says. Some people can make themselves heard without raising their voice. Even so, some of the older players misinterpret Benji at first and reply, She doesn't care if we're on time or not. Benji's reply is brief, but the silence that follows it is deafening. I care. Power is the ability to get other people to do what you want. Every adult man in that locker room could have rendered the 18-year-old powerless by remaining seated on the benches. But he gives them 30 seconds. And when he walks back to the ice, they get up and follow him. That's not when he becomes their team captain. That's just when they all, including him, realize that he already is. Benji doesn't want to lead his team, but he does so anyway. William Leach is over in Hied, and he wants nothing more than to be told to lead his team, but he isn't. It isn't fair, but sports isn't fair. The player who spends the most hours practicing doesn't always end up being the best, and the player who deserves to be made team captain isn't always the most suitable. It's often said that hockey isn't a contemplative sport. We just count goals. That isn't strictly true, of course. Hockey counts everything. It's full of statistics, yet it's impossible to predict. It's governed too much by things that aren't visible. One term that is often used to describe talented players, for instance, is leadership qualities. Even though this is an utterly immeasurable concept, seeing that it is based on things that can't be taught. Charisma, authority, love. When William Leet was younger and Kevin Erdahl was made team captain, William heard the coach say to Kevin, "You can force people to obey you, but you can never force them to follow you. If you want them to play for you, they have to love you." Perhaps no one loved Kevin more than William did, and he did all he could to get that love reciprocated. He was unfailingly loyal, even after the rape. He followed Kevin to Hied Hockey when Kevin's best friend Benji stayed with Beartown. William gathered his guys and beat up both Amit, who had snitched on Kevin, and Bobo, who tried to defend Amit. When Kevin suddenly disappeared, William stayed at Hied, disappointed but still faithful. He has the same coach he had in Beartown, David. It was he who persuaded William and almost all the other old players to switch clubs. Not by defending Kevin, but by using the simplest argument that sports can offer. "We are only interested in hockey, not politics. What happens off the ice stays off the ice." William believed him, and deep down he hoped that now that Kevin and Benji were both off the team, maybe David would finally recognize William's loyalty. But there was no show of gratitude, not a single word of encouragement. He is still being ignored. So when William comes into the locker room today and opens his locker and sees what someone has left in the bottom of it, things happen that no statistics can measure. There's a cigarette lighter lying there. The same sort that filled William's mailbox back in the summer. The same sort Leo had on the beach. At the same time, one of his teammates comes through the door and says, "Hey, Lee, have you heard about Benji? Beartown's new coach has made him team captain." Chapter 23. All It Takes for the Only Thing That Matters. People say that leadership is about making difficult decisions, unpalatable and unpopular decisions. "Do your job," leaders are constantly being told. The impossible part of the job is, of course, that a leader can carry on leading only as long as someone follows him, and people's reactions to leadership are always the same. If a decision of yours benefits me, you're fair, and if the same decision harms me, you're a tyrant. The truth about most people is as simple as it is unbearable. We rarely want what is best for everyone. We mostly want what's best for ourselves. Peter is weighed down by thoughts as he switches his office computer off, puts his files back on their shelves, and walks down the steps toward the ice. He sits down in the standing area at the end of the rink. Fatima is cleaning some distance away. He waves, but she just nods back to him. She doesn't like to draw attention to herself. She has to finish cleaning before the A-team training session starts, and she doesn't want Amit to feel ashamed in front of his teammates. As if that boy has ever felt ashamed of his mother, Peter thinks. Fatima is in many ways a more typical Beartown inhabitant than Peter. Soft-spoken, proud, hard-working, and with absolutely zero tolerance for bullshit. At the start of the summer, when the club's bank accounts were empty, Peter realized that Fatima hadn't been paid, but when he called her, she just said, "Don't worry, Amit and I will manage." Peter knew that Amit went around collecting cans at the end of each month so he could collect the deposit, so he said, heavy with embarrassment, "You can't not get paid. The club has a duty to..." But Fatima interrupted him. "The club? It's my club, too. My boys' club. And we'll manage." It takes a special person to say that. And a special club. It's autumn now, and Fatima has been paid. Peter, too. This morning he tried to pay the bills, and because his computer was playing up, he phoned the bank. The man at the other end was confused. "Those bills have already been paid." Not just one. All of them. Richard Tiu wasn't making empty promises. The sponsor has paid some money in, even though the press conference hasn't taken place yet. Peter will be able to save his club. So why is he so racked with anxiety? The A-team's practice starts. Everyone down on the ice takes it for granted that the lights will go on in the rink every day, that wages will be paid, that fans will flock to games. In hockey, money is always something that is just supposed to be there. We never really grow up in this sport. On the ice, we remain the same kids who just want to play. A puck, a few friends, lights on, let's play. But Peter knows the cost. He's sitting on it. It's just wood and metal, chewing tobacco trodden into the floor, dented railings. But when the men in the black jackets leap into the air in this part of the stand, it bounces. And when they sing, they raise the roof. We are the Bears. We are the Bears. We are the Bears. The Bears from Beartown. We are the Bears. We are. That's a powerful wall to have behind you when things are going well, and a terrible force to have against you when they aren't. Over the years, no one in the club has ever criticized the pack more than Peter. When they fought, he tried to introduce surveillance cameras in the rink. When highly paid players who were underperforming suddenly wanted to tear up their contracts, he tried to prove that they had been threatened by Tima's boys. For years, men in suits stood in the boardroom arguing with Peter because he was being needlessly provocative, when in fact they were frightened too. They allowed the pack to use violence to rule this town as long as it benefited the suit's own purposes. So what now? Now Peter has an opportunity to get rid of the pack, but he's hesitating. Why? Because he feels he owes them for voting to keep him on in the club? Because he's a coward? Or is it about Richard Tiu? Is Peter just afraid that he's exchanging the influence of the hooligans for that of politicians? Who are worse, the guys with tattoos on their necks or the suits and ties? During his first years as general manager, Kira used to remind him that we're not a family that runs from a fight. She's always had thicker skin than he has. The hot-tempered lawyer had more of an appetite for victory than the diplomatic general manager. But now Peter is the one looking for a fight, and Kira the one hesitating. Perhaps Richard Tiu is right about Peter being naive. The world is complicated, but he wishes it were simple. When he was playing in Canada, his coach said, "Winning isn't everything. It's the only thing." But Peter lacked the killer instinct. When his team had a big lead during practices, he would ease up because he didn't want to humiliate his opponents. The coach's philosophy was, "Never take your foot off the enemy's throat." But Peter didn't have it in him. Winning was enough. You didn't have to crush anyone. Then came a practice when their opponents managed to turn around a 5-0 deficit. "Sort your head out," the coach yelled, but Peter never quite managed to. Perhaps that was why he missed that shot in the final 20 years ago, and perhaps that's why he's scared of fulfilling his promise to Richard Tiu now. There's a limit to the number of enemies a man can survive. Peter knows he needs to do his job. He's just not sure which job that is. He sees Elizabeth Zakel on the ice. He wishes he were more like her. She doesn't take her foot off anyone's throat. Elizabeth Zakel divides the players into two teams and ties the teammates together with the ropes. If one player falls, the whole team falls. "What sort of shitty woman's game is this?" one of the older players bellows when he's brought down by an unsteady teammate and hits the ice hard. But Zakel doesn't care. They're made to work until they learn to cooperate and move together as a single unit. They're made to sweat and throw up, not for the last time. Only when Amit sinks to his knees does Zakel let them untie the ropes. Then she fetches her paintball gun. One of the older players mutters, "The bloody woman's had some sort of stroke." Perhaps Zakel reads his lips, who knows? But she says, "I understand that there's a lot of talk of women. I can only assume that you're worried you might start playing like women if you're coached by one." The players squirm. Some of them are still being sick in the buckets. Zakel fires a paint pellet at the crossbar of one of the nets, making the metal sing and the hard little ball explode in a splat of yellow. I coached a girls' team once. They were no good at dealing with rebounds in front of the net and didn't want to block shots. They were frightened it was going to hurt. So I got them to strip off and try to skate from the center line to the net and touch the post while I tried to hit them with a paintball gun. Every time they got there, they earned themselves a beer. You know what they said to me? No response, so she answers her own question. They told me to screw myself. But obviously, they were women. So what are you? The men on the ice stare, but Zakel waits them out. A minute passes. Some of the men giggle nervously, but she stands motionless with the paintball gun. You're kidding, right? Someone eventually asks. I don't think so. I've been told I'm no good at humor, Zakel informs them. Then another player stands up. He puts his helmet down on the ice, then pulls off his jersey and pads until his top half is naked. Will this do, or do I have to get my cock out as well? Benji asks. That'll have to do, Zakel replies, and fires a pellet of paint that just misses his neck. All the other players hunch up, but Benji doesn't hesitate. He just takes off and skates straight at the net. The first time he touches the bar, Zakel manages to hit him twice. The second and third times, she manages to fire twice as many pellets. According to the man in the shop, the pellets move at a speed of 300 feet per second, so Zakel is strongly advised to fire only at people wearing protective clothing from at least 30 feet away. Benji's skin is bare. Zakel manages to land one shot on his back, and he jerks with pain as the paint dribbles down his shoulder blade. The older players look on, at first as if they can't quite believe their eyes, then with increasing fascination. In the end, someone yells out a number. No one remembers if it was 8 or 9, but after that, the whole team counts each time Benji touches the bar. Eventually, they are roaring the number of beers he's won. 14! 15! 16! Zakel reloads the gun, and Benji sets off again. No normal person would behave like that. That's the point. Zakel doesn't want a normal team captain. At one point, Zakel hits Benji right on his collarbone and sees in his eyes what he's capable of. I can win anything with this one, she thinks to herself. He doesn't stop skating, and she doesn't stop firing until he's earned a whole crate of beer. She fetches it from the bench. As she gives it to him, she says, Anyone who feels responsibility isn't free, Benjamin. That's why you're scared. For someone who's bad with feelings, the woman's not so bad with feelings after all. Benji walks to the locker room, bruised, stinging, and spattered with paint. There he shares the beer with all of his teammates. Even Amit drinks. He wouldn't dare turn it down. Benji goes and showers on his own. For a long time. When he comes back, the beer is all gone, and his shoes are full of shaving cream. Peter Anderson stands behind the boards while Zakel picks up her ropes. You have very interesting coaching methods. Do they really make the players better? Peter asks, as diplomatically as he can, while he tries his very best not to hyperventilate at the sight of the splats of paint all over the ice. Better? How should I know? Zakel replies, unconcerned. You must have some reason for using these methods, Peter says. He has a migraine. Richard Tiu promised him complete control over this club, but it really doesn't feel like it. Hockey coaches don't know as much about what we're doing as we pretend. Most of it's guesswork. I assumed you knew that, Zakel replies. Peter feels the muscles in his back tighten. You have an unusual view of leadership. Zakel shrugs. If the players think I'm an idiot, they've got someone to talk to each other about. Sometimes a team needs an enemy to unite them. Peter watches her as she walks off. He could almost swear she was smiling slightly when she made that last remark. Then he goes and fetches cleaning materials and spends several hours scrubbing and wiping the paint off the ice. Perhaps he should have gone home instead, to drink wine with his wife and fall asleep in their bed. But he and Kira haven't quite made up yet. They've just stopped arguing, and that's not the same thing. They're not yelling at each other, but they're not really talking either. The whole family is getting quieter and quieter, like a room that's become such a mess that it feels less bother to brick up the door than get to grips with the problem. Peter realizes he's trying to make work for himself, so he goes home, getting there after everyone has gone to bed. Then he lies awake half the night reading the instruction manual of a coffee machine, instead of calling the daughter who gave it to him and confessing that he doesn't have a clue what he's doing anymore, or for whose sake he's fighting. The A-team coach in Hyeod is named David. His red hair hasn't been cut in months, and his face is chalk white because even on a fine summer's day, the sun doesn't reach into the video room inside the rink. He's giving the job everything he's got. He has to. His girlfriend is pregnant, and Hyeod hockey is his career trampoline to a higher league if he wins. He never wanted to coach this A-team. He wanted to coach Bear Towns. He fashioned a group of small boys all the way until they were juniors, when they were lined up to win the national championship and become the core of the A-team. Kevin and Benji on the ice, David on the bench. That almost happened, but only almost. David didn't leave Bear Town because he wanted to defend rape. At least that's not how he sees it. He doesn't even know if Kevin is guilty. The boy was never convicted of any crime, and David is neither a lawyer nor a police officer. He's a hockey coach. If hockey clubs start to punish players for things that not even a court would punish them for, where would that end? Hockey needs to be allowed to be hockey. Life outside the arena needs to remain separate from life inside. So David didn't leave Bear Town because of what Kevin was accused of, but because Peter saw to it that the boy was arrested on the day of the final, which meant that the whole team was punished, not just Kevin. David couldn't accept that. So he switched clubs and took almost all of Bear Town's best players with him. He doesn't regret his decision. The only thing he regrets is Benjamin Ovich. That boy symbolized everything David wanted from a team, but when it really mattered, David wasn't able to get through to him. Benji stayed in Bear Town when all the others switched to Hyeod. And back in the spring, David saw him kissing another boy. Benji doesn't know that David knows, and evidently no one else knows either. If David is honest, he can't help hoping that no one else ever finds out, either. This isn't the sort of place where he'd wish a revelation of that sort on any hockey player, not even if he's coming here as an opponent this autumn. Is David proud of himself? Definitely not. So why doesn't he just go see Benji and tell him the truth? That he is ashamed of having been such a poor leader that the boy didn't feel safe enough to tell the truth about himself. Why doesn't David just apologize? Probably for the same reason that all of us commit all our stupidest mistakes. It's hard to admit that we've been wrong. And the bigger the mistake, the harder it is. David never imagines that he's a good person, but he does believe he does all he can for the good of hockey. He puts the team, the club, the sport first. He's never going to let it get political, not even now. There's a knock on the door of his office. William Leet is standing in the doorway. "Have you heard that Benji's been made team captain of Bear Town?" the huge forward roars. The coach nods. "This is Hyeod, not Bear Town. Don't worry about what they're doing." William is quivering on the threshold of the room, unable to bring himself to leave, even though the look on his coach's face indicates that that's the end of the discussion. "Is anyone in our team going to wear number 16 this year?" William asks. He doesn't mean it as an accusation. He's just asking his coach to love him. And that's the problem. Love is like leadership. Asking for it doesn't help. "That's not your concern," David says coldly. 16 was Benji's number in Bear Town. David is refusing to give it to anyone in Hyeod. "Who's going to be our captain?" William asks jealously. David answers the question he really wants to ask. "You're too young, William." It's a very particular way of breaking someone's heart when a hockey player sees in the eyes of his coach that he really wants someone else. "Would you have said the same thing if I was Benji?" David is honest. He shakes his head. William Leet goes out onto the ice with a greater need for violent affirmation than ever. David pretends not to understand, but of course he does, all too well. He didn't become a hockey coach by accident. He knows what his words can accomplish. All while the boys were growing up, he has watched William compete against Benji for everything, without winning a single time. David knows that jealousy is a terrible feeling, but it can also be a motivating force. So he distributes it in small doses, on purpose, because leadership is a matter of manipulating emotions to achieve results. David knows that what he's doing is dangerous. He knows that William may well hate Benji so much that he'll hurt him in the game. But all the best hockey teams have someone who plays on the edge and sometimes goes over it. William is at his best when he's full of hate. David still loves Benji, more than any other player he's coached, and he's ashamed that the boy didn't dare confide in him. One day, David may be able to make up for that as a human being, but those feelings belong to life outside the rink, and this is life inside. Here, Benji is an opponent. If William crosses the line in the game, then so be it. If Benji gets injured, then Benji gets injured. David's a hockey coach. He's doing his job. He's doing all it takes for the only thing that matters. Winning. Benji is lifting weights on his own in the outhouse at the kennels when darkness falls. Before he raises the bar, he takes off his wristwatch. It's old and worn, heavy and clunky, and doesn't really suit him. But it was given to him by David. They haven't spoken a word to each other since the coach switched clubs, but Benji still doesn't go anywhere without it. William Leet is doing push-ups until his arms hurt as much as everything else. He falls asleep holding the cigarette lighter that was left in his locker. He knows who put it there. William might not be thinking of hurting Benji. Not yet. But that doesn't mean he can't hurt someone else. Chapter 24. But the bear inside her has just woken up. Ramona stomps down the stairs from her apartment in a cloud of invective to see who's banging on the door of the bearskin after closing time. She's expecting to see a drunk, but finds something else. What are you doing here, you silly old fool? It must be at least 40 years since you last showed up at my door trying to get a drink in the middle of the night. It didn't work then, and it's not going to work now, she snaps at Suna as she buttons her dressing gown. Suna laughs so loudly that he frightens the puppy beside him. I need a piece of advice, Ramona. 2, maybe. Ramona lets him in and gives the dog a bowl of water. The dog empties it and starts to chew the furnishings. Well, she grunts. I want you to talk to Team Arrhenius for me, Suna says. If anyone else had asked, Ramona would have said, Team who? But not Suna. The old man has spent all his life dealing with difficult boys with a talent for hockey, while Ramona has spent hers dealing with the ones without any talent. About what? The club. I thought you'd stop being coach. What have you got to do with the club? They're keeping me for the women. Eye candy. Ramona laughs up a whole decade of cigarette smoke. Then she gets serious. There are rumors, Suna. The paper's talking about a new sponsor and the GM taking part in secret meetings. That sort of thing makes Tima and his boys nervous. It's their club. It's not only their club, Suna corrects her. He can't help thinking what a colossal nightmare of a town this is in which to try to make anyone happy. If the club had gone bankrupt, Peter would have gotten the blame. And now that he's managed to save it financially, he's still getting shit. Ramona puts 3 whiskey glasses on the counter. 1 for Suna, 2 for her. So what do you think about the new coach? She comes here and eats potatoes from time to time, she says. Does that count? I don't know. She's mad. She doesn't seem to give a damn about what Peter Anderson thinks. Ramona grins. Good start. But I have a suspicion Tima and his guys aren't quite so enthusiastic about having a female coach. Ramona snorts. They love their club. You know that. They're worried she's been appointed as some sort of PR stunt. They don't want to be made fools of, and they don't want to see a load of political agendas dragged into hockey. Suna rolls his eyes. Agendas? Is that what we're calling it now? Can't women be allowed to sleep with whoever they like? Ha! There's no one who has more sympathy for lesbians than me. Because as far as I can see, they've drawn the winning ticket. There's no reasoning with men, so you might as well get rid of them. So what's the problem with Zakel, then? The problem is that the boys think she's steered by Peter Anderson and the sponsors and the politicians. And they don't want another coach who's... She stops herself. Suna takes over. Who's like me? Weak. He knows what people say about him. That he let the sponsors and politicians take over the club in recent years, and let them run the club into the ground without a fight. People are right. Suna got older, too tired to argue. He always hoped that the hockey would be good enough to keep the club on an even keel, both financially and morally, but he was proven wrong on both counts. I didn't mean any criticism, Ramona mutters. Oh, they're right. I wish I'd given this town more to be happy about. But Zakel isn't me. In what way? She's the sort who wins. You're here for my advice? The boys need proof. Suna sighs. Then tell Tima that as soon as his little brother gets let out of custody, he should go straight to the rink. Ramona is left speechless. That takes a lot of doing. Peter gets home late again. Kira is sitting at the kitchen table with her laptop. She came home from work early today to cook for the children and do the washing and cleaning. Now she's working again, but without her bosses seeing. She puts in more hours than any of her colleagues, but will soon be known in the office as the woman who always goes home early. Being a mother can be like drying out the foundations of a house or mending a roof. It takes time, sweat, and money, and once it's done, everything looks exactly the same as it did before. It's not the sort of thing anyone gives you praise for. But spending an extra hour in the office is like hanging up a beautiful painting or a new lamp. Everyone notices. Peter talks to her, she talks to him, but without making eye contact. How was your day? Fine. How was yours? Fine. Have the kids eaten? Yes, there's leftovers in the fridge. Can you drive them to school tomorrow? I need to get to the rink early. She says, of course, even though she feels like yelling, and what about my job? He says, thanks, even though he feels like whispering, I feel like I'm drowning. She says, no problem, when she feels like shouting, help. Neither of them says anything else, even though they're both thinking, I miss us. Peter leaves the kitchen without running his fingertips through her hair. She sits there without breathing against the back of his neck. Ramona is staring at Suna. Is this some kind of joke? No, Elizabeth Zakel has no sense of humor. Is she going to let Vidar play hockey again? What does Peter say about that? She doesn't care what Peter thinks. Ramona chuckles. She's always been a bit fonder of the Renius brothers than all of the Bearskin's other boys. Tima gets her groceries for her every week. Vidar used to do his homework here. Many years ago, just after Holger died, the boys heard someone say that Ramona had started to forget things, could be Alzheimer's. It wasn't. It was just a perfectly ordinary broken heart. But the boys read online that you can delay the aging process in the brain, so they started forcing her to do crosswords. Every morning they would bring her a new one. She swore loudly and loved them unconditionally for that. So now she says, so Vidar shits on a desk and Zakel doesn't give a shit about Peter? That's not going to end well. No, Suna agrees. Ramona scratches under her chin with one of the whiskey glasses. It's not like you to go against Peter. No, Suna concedes. Why? Is she that special, this coach? Suna sighs deeply, making the hairs in his nostrils sway wildly. Either we win or we go under, Ramona. Vidar.